This is the Legendary Shards Podcast. I'm John Facci, bass player of the Shards.
I'm Chris Fisher, lead vocalist of the Shards.
Hey, Chris, you know, if you wanted to start your own podcast, you need Anchor.
Anchor? What's Anchor?
Anchor is the best way to start a podcast. They give you everything you need. It's free. And you use your Anchor on your phone or computer.
And it's called Anchor.
Yeah, Anchor.
How is that spelled? Is that A-N-C-H-O-R,
the yes.
traditional Anchor?
True.
Very good.
Yep. They got creation tools. They allow you to record and edit your own podcast. And it even distributes your podcast.
Very nice. I'll keep that in mind.
Yep, you can be heard everywhere from Spotify to Apple Podcasts and many more.
The kids love the Spotify.
Yeah. So you download your Anchor app and go to anchor.fm.
Anchor.fm. Got it. I've written it down. I'm ready.
All right. Sweet.
Do you want to talk about the early days a little bit?
You could write a song. Remember one time, remember the short-lived attempt that we thought we might write a book together, a story, a novel?
Yeah, but we couldn't agree on one sentence.
We couldn't agree on anything. We had completely different visions.
Exactly, yes.
And we said no.
That didn't work.
And we were best of friends, and we would do a lot of things together. But I guess we always had kind of a strong visions of certain things. And when it came to that, we just realized that wasn't going to work out.
Yeah, yeah.
But we started talking about possibly writing a song. Could we write a song?
I don't remember the specific conversations. I remember being around Schenectady. I remember being on the bike trail or the, you know, and the old tracks and all that and talking about it. And I remember you saying, well, if you're going to write the lyrics, then you've got to sing the song, you know, which was because, again, I had no where you picked up the guitar, could play the guitar. I had none of that musical talent nor any reason to think I could, you know, write a decent song. Or I'm starting to think I can carry a tune only because friends are now commenting that when I sing to the radio or whoever we have on, that it kind of sounds good. So, so that's the beginning of that. And like I said, you coming back from Paris and bringing Alive She Cried and the Doors into the picture.
Yeah.
I had a very traditional vision of songwriting because it's all I had ever been exposed to, you know. So when you played Alive She Cried and Morrison's putting poems in there and it's just a whole different, you couldn't really get any further from Bruce Springsteen than...
It's kind of ironic. It's funny that brought up, because I always think of Cy playing Purple Haze. And I remember seeing what he did and always trying to emulate it, but could never, you know, really master it. But I always knew the chords. So that one day we were sitting in a parking lot in Schenectady, and he said, "You think we could write a song?" And he said, "I'll try, you know."
In the Big End parking lot?
We're in the Big End parking lot.
Yep.
And it looked up, and there was a big billboard for Newport Cigarette, the box.
I thought it was Carlton. Was it Newport? You would know better than me.
But it was...
Now, Carlton was, if you smoke... Please try Carlton. Remember? Like they were a more gentle, please try Carlton if you're going to smoke.
But I guess that was new. I guess we're that old, right?
Yeah, the box was new. Can you imagine?
Cigarette.
Now you can't even get a soft pack. I used to like the soft pack because with the hard box,
Yeah.
It's the same volume, whether there's one cigarette in it or 20.
Right.
Where the soft pack would reduce. Right. But anyway.
Yeah, so I don't know. I'll never remember the words to it.
I have no recollection either.
But we decided to name it The Box. I don't think it was about a box or anything else.
It was horrible.
We just told, but I stole the chords from Purple Haze directly. And that was our first song. And
it did not, however, approach the greatness of Purple Haze.
No, not at all. It's ironic, right?
But a necessary step.
Well, it's kind of like the argument about Stairway to Heaven. You know, and everybody says, oh, this other band wrote that song. It's like, well, they didn't write Stairway to Heaven.
No,
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Why even bring it up? Now you're just embarrassing yourself.
Well, like you say, there's only so many chords.
Right.
That's what it comes down to.
So, yeah. And, unfortunately for all the people in our lives that were always aggravated that we dedicated it to music, we played that song for someone and they said it was good. So we pursued it more.
Thank God they lied to us. Oh, and we wrote more mediocre to bad songs.
Yeah.
And then I remember, you know, kind of being back and now we're mobile, you know, we're of age, we have automobiles.
Yeah.
I'm in, just some memories are in Schenectady, some are in Dalton. I remember you coming to Dalton in the summer. I think we now have maybe three or four bad songs under our belt and going up to the fairgrounds with my friends and playing these songs and they were just blown away.
Yeah.
Not because, again, they were great songs. I think just because here were, you know, these two guys who they knew sitting in front of them doing it, you know, playing the songs, performing them. And they really liked it. So thank God. Yeah, that might have been our last bit of encouragement.
That's true.
It really might have been. And thank God they did, because it kind of kept you going along, you know, and trying to get better. And then about that time, again, we're 1990, and came home from Chicago, and, well, that's well before 90 then, right? That's got to be...
I'd say we really started writing music in 1990.
So the summer before we go to Chicago.
Yeah, and then that's what I came down and briefly worked with you at Mr. T's. And which was, how would you describe that? A sports clothing store?
Yes, a pro sports clothing store.
Okay. And and then that didn't work out. We were trying to get into an apartment together, but it wasn't working out, and then they were having bankruptcy issues.
Well, when you're young and you're going to get an apartment, you really got to think about the cost of the incidentals.
Yeah, you might think you can afford,
handily
afford the rent, but you'd still got to buy toothpaste.
Yes.
You can't forget about the toothpaste.
Thank God we got talked out of that.
Although it was economically the most intelligent thing we would have ever done.
And I know we touched on it, but the first, you know, time we hit on something is What Do You Say? And that's when I come, you know, this is again pre-Chicago.
Yeah.
And I come to your house and you've got that song. And that was the first time that I thought, wow, that like has a real melody and is kind of cool. Yeah. And from that point on, things start getting better. You got What Do You Say? We wrote
Tinted Glass.
Tinted Glass.
What Do You Say and Tinted Glass were like our first two breakthrough songs that we actually thought were good.
Yeah, yeah. And then we head off to Chicago, and while we're there, we write, I know we wrote Katie.
Katie.
And there might have been a couple more.
Yeah.
But they're getting better. They're not, there's no question they're starting to get better.
Yeah.
And
we got the guts to do an open mic.
Oh, yes. We did the open mic at the Tracks.
Yeah.
Which was, we did two, right?
We did two open mics. We went the first time, and that was like, we decided to go strong. we had some sort of ballads and love songs, like What Do You Say, and Katie.
Pick up the phone,
and then we had a couple that were a little heavier.
Like, Red Barn was one we called it. The Red Barn.
I'm trying to think of the three songs we did the first time, and I'm not completely sure. I know Tinted Glass was one, and we considered them a little bit heavier
songs.
That
was
so we brought the tape recorder, and the first time there was no one there, so we just pressed play and went up. And
I was terrified. I didn't drink a beer. I mean, beer is my sustenance at that point in my life. I didn't have one.
Yeah.
I was tight as could be. I was a nervous wreck. I remember
pressing so hard. I mean, I played in church throughout my teenage years. And I had no, at that point, fear of playing in front of a lot of people. I was so nervous that night that I was pressing so hard on the chords.
Yeah. I think the only people that came that night were those two, like Laura, was that the bartender's name at Saluki's? And her friend came.
Oh, that's right.
That's right. Yeah. Laura, you had a big crush on Laura.
I think, as usual, was a little too slow on that one. I think there was more of an, I always thought there was more of an opportunity than I let myself believe.
Yeah, you had to strike.
Yeah.
You just let it play out, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, you formed a friendship with her, and they did come.
Yeah.
But it was not a great effort.
Well, we pressed play on the tape recorder, went up and played, and what we took as encouragement was that the crowd went quiet. So you could hear the talking and the chatter. And then once we started playing, everybody went quiet.
They
so
did listen.
We considered they did listen. A victory.
Yeah. So then we went back again.
Yeah.
But that was a triumphant return.
Well, I was...
Again, just that bit of encouragement to keep you trying to get to the next level.
And the host seemed to like what we were doing.
Yes.
I mean, I think even the first time, that was the thing. We were going off and he looked at us and... kind of in a hushed tone, on stage, whatever, but he's like, come back, So we actually got a positive reaction. When we were in Chicago and I was going to the Art Institute of Chicago, you came out and you intended to find a job and just to come out. Well, that wasn't working out too good. So you, at that point, realized you were probably heading back to Pennsylvania, and so we decided to do one more.
Yeah, I was running out of money fast.
Yeah, we decided we're going to do one more open mic before you leave. This time we had a beer or two.
Yeah, I definitely made a concerted effort to drink before that one.
Yeah, our friend Eric was manning the tape recorder. And although it was lost to history, it was an epic recording where he did an excellent job of.
And it was a packed house that night too.
Yeah. And he announced us and gave us a good intro. And we decided to tug at the heartstrings and play a little more of our ballads, and which was probably a good idea. And and you did a little monologue. So your inner Bruce came out and you addressed the crowd and you won them over.
I believe, and I don't remember it word for word, but It was just a story of me having to leave town because, you know, time was up. I was out of money.
Yeah.
And I had to go home.
Right.
And that did seem to capture the crowd.
And I believe and get you're them behind offered us. A job
at I was car offered wash a job at a car to wash. Stay yep. In Chicago. To stay, to continue forwarding our dream.
I worked at a car wash in Schenectady. I can't imagine what you would have run into working at a car wash in Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I probably would have, but he offered me the job, but like couldn't give me 40 hours or something. Yeah. I don't know. Well,
when I got hired at the car wash, you ever seen the movie On the Waterfront?
Mm. Yes.
You remember how they would, whether they had those tickets or coins or whatever it was, that the day workers, you had to have one to work, and they would, you know, hand out to the favorite people or whoever was doing favors for the mob or whatever. And then, you know, the guy get tired, bored of that. And he'd throw it on the ground, whoever could pick one up, you know. Well, when I started working at that car wash, the legendary Rainbow Car Wash on Erie Boulevard that had the great neon sign.
Yeah.
It was basically a bunch of people would show up. And they would pick who would work and send some people home. It was just like that. It was so backwards, that place. And I mean, actually, I got hired by the guy who passed away like the day he hired me, basically. And I came in the next day and I never actually worked for him. Yeah. And the replacement, they were a little more organized. So that actually didn't happen that way after that. But it was kind of an odd, you know, thing. But like I said, I guess, you know, you never know who's going to work. And if, depending on the weather, if it rains, they shut down and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I never worked at the car wash. We had a great night of music, a great reaction.
A great tape that,
yeah,
again, we lost.
Terrible. Eaten. Stupid.
The fates of cassettes.
But, so that was it. I didn't leave. I don't know if I was there another week even.
No.
And got on the train and headed home.
Yeah.
So then we're separated for a fairly good amount of time.
Yeah.
6 months, 6-8 months maybe.
About 3 months. Was it? Semester's time.
Another semester you had. So John's in Chicago. I'm back in Pennsylvania. I get back to Pennsylvania. And now we're going to do the music thing one way or another. Katie turned out to be really good and, you know, some of the stuff we were working on. So we're definitely going to do it.
But we had a lot, like I said, even though in spite of the success of that one night with the ballads and stuff, we started getting, you know, deeper into the Doors influence. And we decided, you know, we're not going to do these sissy ballads anymore.
Yeah, yeah, yes. And as far as I go now, I'm starting to write poetry.
Right.
Which changes everything. Because many of our early songs, even, you know, Bring It All Back, you know, they were poems.
Right.
That would then be expanded or not expanded, and I would just do the Morrison thing, where you do the same short little poem twice and it's a song or something, right, you know? I mean, but that was definitely a game changer. While I'm home alone, I'm writing poetry. I also had recordings that I lost of me sitting at my stereo drinking bourbon. You could hear the glass tinkling in the ice and I would recite my poems, The Cat with No Tail. You remember The Cat with No Tail?
Yes.
There were a number of good poems. I still have my little booklet of all those old poems I wrote, some of which turned into songs, some were just poems. Yeah. But that was also very important because now, and as we've said before, you know, you were the artist, I was the jock. Well, now I start writing poetry. Boy, that's as far from, you know, I'm kind of crossing the line now from, out of that jock realm into the artist realm. Right. And my friends who are all jocks are looking at me like, writing poetry? What? You know. What?
Right.
But I'm heading in a different direction than the Dalton boys at that point. You know, I'm already away from them. And, you know, I still have, I guarantee you 90% of my friends that were with me then, 30 years ago, are doing the same thing with the same people at the same places as they were 30 years ago. Right. You know, I'm already gone. I know I want to be gone, and I'm really mentally already gone. And when I get back, I walk into McGonagall's Corner Store, the little store down, you know, a couple doors down from my parents' house. And I walk in there, and there's this older woman who, you know, it turns out I would have a penchant for as life went on. But, you know, if I'm 20 at the time, she's probably 35 and fine. I mean, like, there are only a few times in my life where, like, lust physically affects me, you know, through 52 years. I walked into that store and saw that woman and was shaky. I mean, she was that desirable to me. But it also turned out she was kind of part of that group with Wade Rose and those people who you'll hear about at a later date. Okay. But she was maybe a little older than him, but part of all that. And her name was Cindy. And we just took
Cindy
a
with an S, wasn't it?
Yes. fittingly. But we took a shine to each other and ended up hanging out here and there. And one night I'm in her apartment, and I think it might have, I don't even know where I got it, but I was wearing this black obsidian kind of crystal thing around my neck at the time, and we're laying on the floor of her apartment, and she's looking at it, and she says, "That reminds me of, have you ever seen the movie The Dark Crystal?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, there's a rock like that in there, and they call it the Shard." And I said, "The Shard?" She said, "Yeah, the Shard." And I said, right on the spot, "That's it. That's our name, the Shards."
He could not come up with any name. When we went up on stage at the Tracks in Chicago, and we were John and Chris. So we just, and we could never come up with anything good. And that was a minute, the moment, and it was immediate.
Yep. I think I called you, told you, you were in agreement. Yep. So from that point on, and now we're, you know, 91, yep. Summer of 91, it's the Shards.
Right.
Though just still John and Chris.
But yeah. But so we're the acoustic duo. And our music and music aspirations were almost like a form of contraband. There was really no place to openly do it. Oddly enough, then.
No, we would always sit in your car,
yep,
with the box between us and play and record.
Yeah, old boom box was actually my sister's, which I don't know if it was just the car sealing out most of the sounds or something, but the recording quality was surprisingly good.
Yeah.
And that one night, we went down by the Dalton School, by the, was it, Route 6 and 11 overpass, and we wrote Children of the World. The Doors' influence had finally kicked in.
Yeah. At this point, John's back from Chicago, and we're still progressing. And the Door, like John just said, the Door's influence is now, we're trying to write things that are different than what we had heard from Bruce and, you know, the stuff on the radio. I mean, we're trying to go a little deeper than that.
Yeah. And so it was a bit more of a mystical sound, and that recording, again, lost to time, was had all these magical sound effects from the cars whooshing over the overpass and stuff like that, and so many incredible effects that, you know, things just start happening accidentally,
which are always the best things.
Yeah.
And I remember playing it and singing it in your car. I don't really remember writing it, but early on, and I've told you this, and I didn't tell anybody at the time, I would write words to the cadence of other songs that I was into or that were in my head, you know? So I'm sure Children of the World is to a cadence of now some long forgotten song that everyone would know, but I just figured, well, the hell with it. I got to get words down on paper. If this does it, nobody but me knows that, you know, I'm writing this song to the cadence of, you know, whatever Doors song or whatever.
And it was a good practice. I did something similar when I wrote What Do You Say, actually. And the singer's name, it was Chet Baker. There was, for some reason, at that time, on MTV or VH1, maybe it was VH1 at the time, but for some reason, he was making a bit of a comeback. Chet Baker was an old blues, I think he played trumpet, a blues man from like the 60s, and for some reason he was having a resurgence in popularity, and they kept playing the song Almost Blue, and it definitely captured me as something I wanted to do. And I did the same thing where I kind of just matched the cadences. And, you know, there's a certain, for writing songs, there's a strange benefit to not being able to play, other people's music as perfectly as other people can. So it kind of gets you a head start, and you find yourself doing something differently anyways.
Yeah.
You know, and so you go with it. So it's like the failed attempts to play or figure out covers often brought you the new music that you're trying you could write. And that was a similar, so we did Children of the World and Save Me was was born of a failed attempt to learn Love Me Two Times and Lady Blue was a little triumvirate of songs that we came up with.
And I remember at that point, you know, I can sing to the radio. I can sing to, you know, whatever tapes I have. I can let it loose. I can do whatever doing that. But singing our songs, I'm having trouble, you know, really letting loose. And I can remember you just imploring me, no, you've got to sing it. You've got to sing it. You got to sing out. You've got to sing out. And it's hard to do. If you've never done it and you're not a natural, it's hard to do.
You never liked your voice.
No, well, does anyone? I don't know.
I never liked my voice on recordings either.
No.
But there was a quality to your voice. And we were doing the earlier songs, and for some reason, I always think of Tinted Glass. To me, was when I thought that you had a voice that we could market. And it wasn't exact, but for some reason there was a quality to it that reminded me of like early ZZ Top and like the Grange, you know. It is just I just watched on I think it was Netflix, the ZZ Top documentary, which was excellent. they, you know, for some reason, that's what I was hearing in your voice at the time, or maybe the effect that we had, you know, or what, non-effect on our tape recorder, but there was just a sound there that I always thought you had the quality.
Well, I don't know when, you know, I just kept trying and trying. I think really when I finally probably let it go was maybe, you know, when now I'm in Schenectady at the apartment and we start playing with Joe and Jim a little bit. And now you got other guys that you don't want to let down, you know, you got to lay it out there at some point. And once you do, it's a huge step, you know, and I tell any young person now that wants to sing, I mean, that's the key, letting it go. Once you're not afraid of making a fool of yourself, you can maybe do something great. But if you're afraid of making a fool of yourself, you're never going to do anything great.
Well, ironically, the revolution of, you know, these TV talent contests, American Idol and things, you know, I always thought it was ironic that the greatest rock singers of all time would have never won those contests.
Yes, no.
So they're all competing for something that is impossible. And, you know, there was a couple, and, you know, I get, I can understand, like, some of the, I don't know, some of the female singers that sing a little more traditionally or whatever, they have a strong voice. It kind of makes sense. But for some reason, those guys that won, that, you know, they're on top of the world, they win the contest, but they go away pretty fast.
Yeah, well, it's there's a missing, I mean, something happens. You know, look at Dylan. How do you explain, you know?
The confidence of Mick Jagger. You know, Mick Jagger would never, obviously, ever even get to, you know, the finals of, you know, be invited back on American Idol. But it was just his voice, you know, sung with confidence, right? And that's rock, you know? So really, and then you go through all the punk years on top of that. Right. And so there's, as long as you can get it across, you know, and especially with rock, it all depends on, you know, what you're singing about.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Well, yeah, it's becomes kind of ironic that, you know, I was kind of timid at the beginning because it ended up, my singing ended up being far from that, you know. In fact, it was, you know, it could be browbeating at times, but it's what the Shards became. And part of that was which is probably not popular in this time in history, but a bravado, a testosterone-fueled bravado, in which even, you know, a lot of our early songs, I don't know if we had any love song, certainly not a love song with any vulnerability felt on the part of the man until maybe 16 Stories.
Yeah.
You know, there was, the man was never vulnerable, you know, and this too goes back to having my heart broken at, yes, you know, 22, 23, whatever the hell it was.
Right.
So I was never going to be vulnerable again. And that really shows through in the early, early stuff.
That was definitely the early focus, was to eliminate that from our repertoire.
Yes.
probably to our disadvantage, because some of those songs, I think, were pretty marketable.
Yeah.
And I remember early on playing our tapes, for people. I remember my sister-in-law commenting on pick up the phone, which was one of our early tunes, and what she liked about your voice was she said that I feel like I can hear him smiling on the other side of on the other side of the recording. It's like, yeah, I think a lot of our, there wasn't a lot of smiling in a lot of our early Shark songs.
No, no, maybe an evil, sarcastic kind of smiling, but no.
Yeah, I mean, so in the, you left Chicago in 91, and I held on for another year or so, and I just could not, I did not have the money to keep up with the lifestyle of going to school, you know, halfway across the country, and of course, it's art school. I know books can be expensive in college, but in art school, you got to continuously buy supplies as you're going. So, you know, that all started crashing down around my ears, and I ended up leaving. At that, in between, so my brother got married, and his brother-in-law turned out to be one of the premier blues guitarists in the Albany market. And we started following his band, Split Decision. And I brought you to some of his shows, mm-hmm. I think. And so they were incredible, an incredible three-piece, you know, power blues band that played, you know, Hendrix, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Santana. And if you can imagine the talent that it would take to for a three-piece band to play Black Magic Woman and to cover, you know, all of the rhythm and the all of the percussion of a drummer and a percussionist. Well, they definitely had the drummer that could do it. And that would be Owen Lewis III.
Who will come into our story again.
Yeah.
We tried to, the goal was to get Joey to be our guitar player.
Of course, he was the greatest guitar player we knew.
He was incredible.
Yeah.
I kind of at this point, I'm in Pennsylvania. I haven't moved up here yet. Joey hears a tape. I don't know. Is that the Reverence Record tape? Have we made that?
I might have heard some of the, like I said, the, some of the songs I was playing for my sister-in-law, his sister, you know, and we started trying to get him interested. I was bugging him all the time, you know, playing guitar with him and trying to learn anything I could off of him. So he started hearing it, and then Split Decision broke up after a couple of years, and he was starting to look for a new band, put a new band together. So you started rehearsing with him and trying out for that.
But again, this is pre me being able to sing. So we get in a room with him and a couple other fairly accomplished, you know, musicians. And we start playing things like Tin Pan Alley and Hey Joe and Black Magic Woman. And I can't sing them the way they should be sung, you know. Right. So that becomes, you know, I think I can remember looking at the drummer who immediately is just kind of rolling his eyes and like, who the fuck is this kid and where the fuck did you get him? You know, I mean, he was none too thrilled. By the end of, you know, probably rehearsal two or three, I don't know how many I got through, you know, Joey's discouraged and we go our separate ways. Which is fine because that's how it had to be, you know. And again, that little bit of experience that I got doing that just helped me that much more get me towards where I needed to be.
And we didn't spend a lot of time playing, you know, cover songs or no. that we right from the beginning, it was about writing our own music. Yeah. So there's a difference between you singing your songs that you were writing and singing someone else's.
Yeah.
Yeah. And meanwhile, I'm doing, and we actually started meeting and trying out quite a few guitar players. I mean, we really did.
Well, once I got up here, then yeah. I come up to Schenectady, and yeah, I think we might have even put an ad in the Metroland or something.
I think we did, and just talking to a lot of people. And when I think back on it, there were quite a few that we were really active. I mean, this is what, 93, 94. We're really actively searching at this point. You already started coming up. I got the apartment with our friends and you start coming up and crashing on the couch there. And I've been working landscaping, and that's where I met Ed Dwyer. Well, and so Owen calls like the day after, a day or two after that.
After Ed resurfaces, yes.
No, well, after, yeah, well...
Oh, after the Joey.
After Joe.
See, I thought Ed was back before Owen called, but I thought it was like boom, boom.
We were in contact with him. Remember, we even played with Pearly one day. Remember, Pearly came over with that. He had a sweet reel, like a 57 or 59 Les Paul.
Yeah.
That was sweet gold top. But. You know, I mean, we were sort of in contact with Ed, but Ed was sort of in and out. He was a little transient. At that point, he actually only lived on people's couches, I do believe, as far as I knew him then.
We'll ask him when he's here.
Yeah.
He will be
here. But I do recall that, like, where you live, you know, and that I know that was what he was going through at that point. But so Owen, like I said, followed him and Joey Lowery's blues band for about a year, and he could play, you know, Black Magic Woman, just fill the room, right? And I've seen him totally captivate an audience. He was one of the few drummers that could actually play musically. I mean, you hear great. Remember the old days of like Buddy Rich or someone would go on TV or something and they would have, you know, drum. What do they call them? Drum offs or whatever with another drummer, the host, you know?
Yeah.
And Owen had that where, you know, there's great drummers and there's keeping time and there, all that is good, but he could play, you know, with no one around him. And he would even during breaks of a show, he'd just keep playing, and all of a sudden, like, they played in a park, in Collins Park in Scotia, and all these kids outside in the outside stage, and he just kept playing, and he's just gathering all these kids, you know, and he just had an amazing ability, and he was a little older than us, and he played with a lot of local blues bands, so... I don't know. So is it like a day or two? We heard from Owen. We set the date. We called Ed. And at this point, we're, you know, starting to put together the songs of Blue Shade. He had written Blue Shade. We were working on the riff a little bit. As part of something we were starting to work with Ed when we were getting together. But so we booked a date at New Music in Albany.
Shithole.
Yeah. Yeah, it was hard coming across, but there was a few places.
It was like $5 a fucking hour. It was like $5 an hour. Yeah.
We went in there, and there was this older band in there, and they're like, we've been together for 9 years. And they go, you know, we've written like 11 songs or something, or it might have been less than that, too. And I was just like, wow, that's good. That's good. And we wrote a lot of songs at that point that we threw away and didn't even play anymore. But we went in there, and the first time with Chris, myself, Ed, and Owen, and we started playing, and we started playing Blue Shade. And it... I do remember sort of piecing together, you know, that little riff at one point before that rehearsal, but we just started playing it, and that song was played pretty much exactly the way it's played now. From the first moment, and we... And then the Shards were born.
That night in that room, you felt it immediately. And we pretty much just started writing songs, you know, that I had words for, and maybe John and Ed had noodled with a little bit. But we just started going through them, and the Blue Shade stuff, Brothers and Sisters and Blue Shade and Moving On. And, you know,
in that first rehearsal, we had like four new songs that were almost pretty much complete.
Yeah,
I mean, they developed so fast that see, when we first started, and we were meeting a lot of guitar players, and we were playing with a lot of people. We originally started this story, you know, I was always playing guitar, and we wrote a lot of songs together with me on guitar.
Yeah.
We met a lot better guitar players than I ever was. And I thought it was going to be a lot actually easier to find a great lead player than we didn't even know any bass players.
No.
So I bought my first Fender jazz bass. So that night we had Blue Shade,
Brothers and Sisters.
Brothers and Sisters, and Moving On, maybe Spirit Come Home.
Hmm. Yeah, just boom, 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 boom. I mean,
yeah.
And they were songs and haven't changed much to this day.
No.
So we left there that night feeling pretty good. But even before that, when Owen called, to have Owen call, to not just get a drummer,
no,
but to get Owen,
yeah,
who we, you know, personally, I'd seen play live. And I mean, you were more in with them than I was, but I had seen him. You know, this is a guy that had actually done it, you know.
Yeah,
and, you know, he wasn't playing spec, but still, he was out there in front of people doing it, and that was important, and I think confidence building as well. when heading out, and that he would even call us was great. Right. That we got into that studio that night and it clicked the way it did.
Yeah.
Was just amazing.
Yeah. Well, they, I think in a lot of it was, there was a foundation of like Owen's musicality, you know, and his ability to improvise and to just play from the heart. Like I said, he's going to get behind a drum set and it's going to be good, you know, and basically as a bass player, when I started playing bass, I started listening to, I mean, like I said, I was bugging Joey. I was playing bass with him. And he really helped me a lot. And, so we were playing, I got used to playing a lot of that blues, you know, that he was big into, and building the structure. And then when I started rehearsing and at home listening to Sabbath and Hendrix, and by that time Hendrix was pretty much my favorite musician, and you realize that the freedom of Hendrix was to, he built a song from the drum rhythm, drum track. He had words. He definitely was a poet himself, and he had the words, and he would establish that rhythm. He would create the bass line that was the foundation for him to do whatever he wanted to do with the guitar. So the guitar just becomes totally like decoration, you know, it's all extra, not bound by anything, you know? So it's like, so that was sort of the music that I started really focusing on. And with Owen, it was just like, he just had to start, he created a little bit of a groove. You create like a mood, whether it's heavy, whether it's like a blues thing, and you just get him going. And it didn't take much, and he was just so creative. And Ed's ability to flourish, you know, was just the perfect blend, you know. And it was fun to be the bass player that kind of translated the drum parts, you know, to what Ed was doing.
Yeah.
That's what it came from, you know, it just came from a different place than, I don't know, writing music down on paper, you know, sight reading and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, it wasn't. And we always pretty much wrote, you know, you guys would play something and it might catch my ear. Yeah. And then I would start leafing through the notebook and right. find something that I thought would work.
Yeah.
And then we'd go from there. Every now and then I'd write as I listened.
Yeah.
You know, I think we'll tell this story later on, but Not Magic was one of those. That was one I didn't have the words to until you guys did the music, and then I came home and listened to it and wrote the words.
Right.
But that was rare. You know, we usually did it all together in a room.
Well, you and I started writing, and we started writing together, you know, and like that first song we made up, I just strummed and you sang, and then you started, you know, writing, and, you know, I would write some lyrics. And we kind of were had this, you know, Lennon McCartney thing, where you're working together, you're writing together, you know, and then I still wrote some lyrics, but I became more involved in the music and the sound, you know, and. So much of our music early on was stuff that I wrote on guitar with you. And as we presented this to Ed and Owen, I then kind of transformed what I played into my bass line, you know, and it, and so they were very hinged on following what I was doing. And I don't know that I was playing traditional bass, but I was projecting, you know, the melody and what you were doing. There wasn't a lot of, there wasn't a lot of explanation, you know, and I guess those years of following, you know, like Split Decision and just that whole blues feel that, you know, that, it just became about, you know, laying down a groove, you know, and, it was all a lot of improvisation, yeah. You know, and we had our, you know, just like any musical, you have your basic form of the song and the rest is just embellishment. Yeah.
And I don't remember, you know, we did that first rehearsal. I don't remember like going in again, but oh, so we do that rehearsal. Then we find the spot in the stockade to record.
Oh,
the yeah, little that's... place on Liberty there.
Yeah. And that was kind of part of the journey, right? Because you and I, as again, it was like, we just wanted to know. So we were going to knock on whatever door, go wherever and just ask. I mean, like even Ed, like, it, so we're doing landscaping and we're mulching a flower bed, you know, and we start talking and he starts just talking about playing guitar. He plays guitar. And I just said, I go, well, are you good? And he goes, yeah, I'm good. That was it. I'm tired. But it was, that's what I mean. There's no, like we, you and I decided at one point that we're going to do this and it just became directly asking or, is it here? Is it there? You know, is it in this door? Is it this person? You know, and just directly. So we go to this studio and they were nice enough to bring us in and talk to us. You know, we're like, what do we do? How do we record? How do we make money doing this? You know, and then they kind of told us, well, we're just a recording studio. You know, you're looking for like a label, someone to see. Like, all right. Yeah, that's a pretty nice place.
That I don't remember.
That was a beautiful place. It was all woodwork, and the guy was explaining, like, they really took the acoustics, you know, this, the. And it was pretty nice.
Well, that's after, I think, though, because early on we get Owen, we rehearse at New Music, we get that spot on Liberty Street,
yeah,
we hang up tie-dye sheets and Christmas lights,
yeah,
and play as loud as we can,
yeah,
and the neighbors immediately start calling the police,
yeah,
and we actually had a recording of the police interrupting a Shards rehearsal one night, which of course unfortunately is gone, but so that was, you know, like the cops basically walked in and were like, what are you doing here? You know,
yeah.
I mean, you're in a residential neighborhood. You're playing at, you know, God knows what volume.
And we just played blasting loud rock. You know, it was just, it was, that was the thing, you know, it was powerful. It was powerful music. It was a different kind of music, you know, it kind of took over.
So at that point, we don't really have anywhere to play. We can't really afford the $5 an hour once or twice a week to do that. We do have a solid place coming, but we don't know it yet. And I think pretty quickly, we open the Metroland, because I think it's at that place on Liberty Street that we do it, to find an open mic.
Yeah, we...
And we find...
Yeah, we...
Mother's Hideaway.
We're feeling...
Mother's Roadhouse.
Pretty good about...
We had four songs we were looking to play
out. Three or four songs. Yeah. Yep.
So we went. It was supposed to be, I think, a Thursday night was the open mic at Mother's Roadhouse on Route 4 in East Greenbush.
Yes.
So we drive out to Mother's to play the open mic.
And at an open mic, you expect there's a drum set there and a setup and the
sound system. We walked in and there's no, the guy's like,
there's nothing.
Sorry.
Well, that's what you don't expect. Like, you don't even bring your amps, you know, to an open mic. We brought our guitars.
Well, yeah, it wasn't even happening. They were advertising it, but it wasn't even happening.
Right.
So the guy says, hey, if you want to go get your equipment and come back and play, you can do that. So you and Ed stole the truck.
Well, we borrowed it. You know, the level of trust there was, we didn't question whether or not we'd be allowed to, you know, and it all worked out. No. To our credit, it worked out. So, I mean, if someone, you know, was really offended by that, I think it would have been carried out. I don't think there was anybody. I think everybody kind of knew what happened. Let's say that.
Well,
because of the, anyways.
Anyway, we got the truck. Got it loaded with our equipment, went back to Mother's, and played. And they liked it. And the bartender, who I think at that point was the owner's son, said, you know, hey, if you guys want to come back for the weekend, Friday and Saturday, you can play and we'll give you the door.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, we'll play our four songs. We might have worked on a fifth or a sixth to try to get us through that night, you know, and the next day a little bit.
We hacked through a few covers that we thought we could do.
Yeah, I think that's where Paint It Black might have. I'm sorry, Sympathy for the Devil.
Yeah, we did like, that was like always the one. Like, even I think in that original rehearsal, we might have done. Yeah. Sympathy for the Devil. It was one song that we liked to do. You and I always did Wish You Were Here, even in the early days. That was one of the few covers we'd work on. And I know we did that one. We did some that weren't that successful.
Well, we went back Friday and Saturday. We had very few songs. We played them over and over. The boys extended any jamming or whatever, you know, they just would play and play and play. And we did that over and over for a couple of days, two decent crowds for that place.
Yeah.
And we did pretty decent making money at the door after the door guy stole whatever he stole from us. So it was pretty good. And we didn't know it. I mean, I've been back up to upstate New York at that point for, I don't know, maybe 6 months. I don't know what Mother's Roadhouse is. And as we pull up, you know, that original night, the Thursday for the open mic, there's motorcycles everywhere and there's signs on the like front of the place that say like motorcycle parking only, all others will be crushed and all this stuff. And you go in.
Japanese motorcycle hanging in the tree.
Yes, a Honda in the tree. Or a Kawasaki or something. So, you know, you go in and they're rough customers. And it's a real biker bar where they wear the colors and everything. And you got to kind of watch yourself. I still, at this point, after the first weekend, don't realize that. I'm pretty clueless still at that point. But they like us. And they tell us, you know, after the second night, they were great. I can remember kind of milling around after and people talking to people and the one guy telling us we were barking up the right tree and all that kind of stuff. So again, the encouragement, there was always a good length of time between encouragements, but when they did come, we grabbed onto them
and
used them to catapult ourselves a little bit further.
We got a lot of good gigs out of that place. I mean, we ended up playing some rallies and things like that.
In the future.
There was a lot of people. It became, you know, they'd be invited to play parties. That one night we played, you know, we played all night at Mother's, and they invited us to a Halloween party after hours. Yeah. So there was a bit of a home for us.
Well, it would be. It would be. But I think then, after the successful first weekend at Mother's, we decide, things happen very quickly at this point. There's a lot of stuff that happened quickly and stuff to come that happens quickly. But I think at that point, we decide, you know, we've got to record something. We've got to get something down professionally on tape.
At this point, and we probably have around 10 originals at that point.
Yeah.
You know.
So we again go to the Metroland and open it up and find Center Stage Productions, I believe, at the time.
Yeah.
And you called.
I called. I was run by a kid that was in my chemistry class back in Lynn High School. Had a great recording studio in his mother's home. It's impressive. So Ed and I, so this is getting into the fall, and Ed and I working for the landscaping company where we met had fall cleanups were coming up that time of the year, and our schedule was to work 7 days a week.
And I can remember you guys leaving at like, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning and coming home at 8, 9 o'clock at night. Absolutely filthy, disgusting.
We would do fall leaf cleanups. At sometimes it would get dark and they would put headlights on the truck. You know, but we're doing 13 hours easy. But they, at that time of the year, they work every day. And they give you a bonus if you show up every day. But, you know, and we, you know, we're good friends with our boss. You know, we knew him. I went out with him, went to see a lot of bands. He's a big music fan, big Deadhead. I don't think he'd admit to being a Deadhead, but he's a huge Grateful Dead fan. Anyways, so to take 2 days off in October was unheard of, and he got pretty upset. Told us not to take the time off. We asked, he said no, and then we did, and he really flipped out about it. So, anyways, so we did. We went into the studio, and we did a Saturday and a Sunday.
Well, do you remember how much, like, when you called Tim, what the arrangement was or what?
I don't remember the initial call. You might have actually called and said it. Well, I think you did. I mean, I'm sure we talked about it, and we talked about doing it. I mean, that was part of, you know, you set the dates. So we were like, all right, so we got to do it. And we did, and we had 6 songs. I said we probably had about 10 songs at that point, but we ended up doing 6 songs. And
I remember the night before being in your and Ed and Christine's apartment.
Yeah.
Like working on stuff, because we didn't really have 10 songs, you know.
We
had maybe 6 and half of 4 others or something.
Bring It
know?
All Back, I think, was established, and we were playing like I said, Blue Shade was the first song that we ever did. So we were playing that, and we, you know, that, like we said, that was formed perfectly first time. So that was one thing we did regularly. And like Brothers and Sisters was something we did a lot, and we, you know, it had a form. Those, and Welcome to Vi was, I mean, that was always pretty much, it is what it is. It just drives through, and that didn't change a lot. But two songs, like one song we hadn't written before the studio, and the other one we had played once. It was it was a really cool tune that Ed, so when you first started coming up to Schenectady, I had an apartment with my friends, couple, their boyfriend and girlfriend, and they wanted to have their own apartment, and they begged me to come in and it's help them. You know, it is a 2-bedroom apartment, and that was like our first permanent step into like adulthood at the time. And so you started coming up, and you were staying the weekends, and then you moved, you got the job locally, and you were pretty much living on the couch there. And I started dating my girlfriend at the time. So that was a funny story that I started talking with my girlfriend about getting this other apartment, and she was worried. It was like right when, just like when I started, moved into that place, that Joe and, that they were worried about, right, making it. They needed somebody else. So I started talking to Ed at work, who was never, like I said before, sleeping on people's couches. So he got the apartment with us, and you moved in to that apartment. Yeah. And Ed got that album what was that with the guys from Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam. I can't remember the name of the album now.
No idea.
But they had this song with that sort of hand tremolo that the guitar player does on the volume knob. Mm. I mean, Joey used to do it where he almost made it sound like he was playing a violin in the Split Decision days. But Ed developed this song with this almost echo sound. And we had done that song once. It was one of your poems. Yeah. But we had played about halfway once. And it's called Can You See Yourself Retreating?
I don't have any recollection of writing it before that day. I remember being in my little booth that day, and we start playing it, I remember having no idea of where it was going to go or how it was going to end. I don't even know if we did other takes. I thought this might have been the take of the day. I don't remember doing it more than once.
I think it was.
And that's why I scream, hey, at the end, because I was so excited that we actually got through it and I thought it was pretty freaking good.
Yeah. Nah, we didn't.
It was one. This is one take.
Yep.
Of a song we had no idea where it was going after the first minute and a half.
Right.
So.
Yeah, after the verse, everything is completely improvised.
Yeah. From here.
Yes.
But that's when the best stuff happens.
That's what always blew my mind about that Miles Davis kind of blew is a completely improvised album. He set sort of parameters and certain things.
Yeah, and, you know, stuff like that where it goes from the dynamics of the song are all happening on the spot, and it's pure feel. It's four men playing, and it's just this heartbeat between them that's creating this.
It was like a conversation. It was, I mean, like you said, we had this basic sound and rhythm. Can you
see yourself retreating? And that's not easy either, what Ed's doing with that volume button. You know, he makes it sound easy, but that's not real easy to do.
Yeah, I've never been able to actually do it myself with that feel. Yeah, we were, I mean, it was amazing that we were able to everything is still the same. This is this was the biggest surprise right here.
Yeah.
Well, when we got the recording back for this, and that happened, what you just heard, shortly after that, or the next time, Ed and I went back to work, which was probably Monday after this recording, and we're listening to the tape. Anyways, so we go in and Tom is hot. Tom is so mad. Tom is so mad that we skipped. It was unheard of. He did not skip 2 days. I mean, and he liked us, so he was more personally offended.
Yeah.
Than because the thing about that job is everybody, you know, comes and goes. There's a bunch of people just barely hanging on, you know, to life, and you'll know if they're gonna show up or not. But. He expected us to show up. So, he gave us such a hard time. He was so mad. And we said, fine, we quit. Fine, we quit this. Because when we heard what we were able to do on that recording, it blew our minds. It simply blew our minds.
Yes. I remember coming home and you guys saying you quit your job.
And we said,
were going to be famous anyway.
We said, you know, if we just, we'd spend it, you know, you're supposed to go to work for 8 hours a day, right? So if we spend 8 hours a day playing this music, then we have to succeed. That's what we need to do. So we began to do that.
Look into me.